The Lifeboat Hour with Michael Rupert, Sundays at 9 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Nice Love at the End of the World. This is Michael C. Rupert, and welcome back to the Lifeboat Hour. It is Sunday, March 27, 2011. We're going to be very busy tonight, and we're going to get down to business very quickly. I want to share with you guys a story that was released on Reuters News Service an hour ago, 4:59 p.m. or so, Eastern Daylight Time. Low-level radiation found in Massachusetts rainwater. The lead is trace amounts of radioactive iodine linked to Japan's crippled nuclear power station have turned up in rainwater samples as far away as Massachusetts during the past week, state officials said on Sunday. Again, I want to stress these are trace elements, or trace levels. These are not immediately harmful or threatening, but that's a sign of the wind pattern that has been blowing with the trade winds from Fukushima, Japan, and the tragedy that is unfolding there. And tonight, as we sit here on this radio show, there is no story that is more important to anyone on this planet than what is happening in Japan. Our guest tonight, Chris Martinson of chrismartinson.com, is a scientist, PhD, trained in, I think it was neurotoxicology. He'll correct me if I'm wrong. But he has been, for the last 5 years, just an incredible analyst, someone who does a master's job of analyzing and presenting facts. He has tens of thousands, probably, of loyal followers around the world who hang on his work with good reason, because it is masterful. Chris has been a regular on the show before, and since the earthquake and tsunami and the advent of the nuclear incident in Japan, Chris has done the best job in the whole world. And I know, because for the World News Desk at CollapseNet, I go through stories from all over the world, about 80 to 120 a day. And he has been the best at analyzing and describing and digging and telling us the truth about what is happening in Japan. We're going to bring Chris on quickly. I'm going to sum up a little bit about what we've done at CollapseNet, because that leads to the first and only question I'm going to ask Chris, and then after that we're going to kind of go where he wants to. Less than 2 days after we became aware of a nuclear accident in Japan, CollapseNet, I issued an alert and a warning to tell all of our members to get potassium iodide as soon as possible. We have seen what's happened since. During this last week, it was disclosed, we had the story on the World News Desk, that the American Embassy in Japan has issued potassium iodide to all staff and family members. That is important, not because we're in danger here on the West Coast or anywhere else in the U.S. yet, but the lingering question, as I posed on April 14th, is this, and we have since learned the answer. If there is a catastrophic core meltdown at any one of the four troubled reactors at Fukushima Daiichi, then in all eventuality there will be six together, because one catastrophic meltdown would trigger all the other reactors and render the area beyond approach. That's been confirmed a couple of times this week. So first of all, Chris, if you're out there, I really want to welcome you back to the show, and boy, there's a lot of people looking forward to hearing from you tonight.
Thank you, Mike. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let me ask my one question. Are we out of the woods yet for the potential of having a catastrophic meltdown at any one of the reactors there?
No. We are in the middle of meltdowns. We know this from all the data and evidence that's come forward. I want to thank you for that kind introduction. I have not had a lot of sleep in the past 2 weeks.
I bet you.
We're at 2 weeks and 24 hours into this particular incident going on over there. You're absolutely right. It is the most important story that's unfolding. I cannot believe that it's mostly been shoved off the front page by a couple of tomahawks. I guess that's, you know, all we can do in this country is about seven, eight days in a row of something. But I would really counsel people not to take your eye off the ball on this because, no, we're not out of the woods.
Yes.
We just had, you know, first of all, we've been suffering with just incredibly bad information. I feel fortunate to have pieced together the information relatively accurately given just the poor quality of the information we've been given so far. But it seemed, well, first of all, you know, on Monday, when I watched Reactor 3 blow up with my own eyes, and it looked like a Fugazi, which is a contraption where you take a pipe and you put some dynamite in the back end and throw crap in the other end, you know, and just boom, let it go, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what it looked like to me. It looked like a focused explosion that went straight in the air. You couldn't convince me otherwise. It wasn't a hydrogen explosion. We could compare it to Reactor 1. We saw that. That's, you know, that was a pure hydrogen explosion. It blew out a couple of side panels. The skeleton of the building was intact. And by skeleton, I mean a steel-framed skeleton. But Reactor 3, something different happened. It chucked a whole lot of ejecta into the atmosphere, about 1,000 feet high. And that right there, right then, I said, okay, that's it. We've at least lost the secondary containment vessel top on that explosion. And I've been working with that as my ongoing assumption. And because that was my initial assumption, you know, that you're going to have to prove me off of that before I'm going to accept something else. I've been operating under the assumption that radioactivity is going to be a lot higher than people said, that we were going to start seeing radionuclides coming from the core, things that would be consistent with core meltdown. That would be, you know, the cladding of the rods has melted down. We're looking at stuff from the center. But even more so, I've been working with people who are certified nuclear engineers asking the question, could these things begin to undergo fission again? And if they can, that's a whole different problem.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, without fission, what we're trying to do is deal with the waste heat that's left over after they've scrammed these things, shut them down. The waste heat, let's not minimize it. It's still like 5 megawatts, you know, for each one of those reactors. Huge amount of heat. You can deal with that. But if they reinitiate, if they went critical again and start undergoing fission, which all sorts of apologists out there in the world, all sorts of nuclear, quote-unquote, experts had been assuring us and, you know, all the major media outlets that was just not possible, here's why. Well, guess what? It happened. And we know that because today, you know, we had that release that they said, you know, first they said it was 10 million times background radiation, but no, maybe it was just 100,000. It doesn't matter. They detected iodine-134 in the waste products in that water outside of Reactor 2.
Right.
And iodine-134 has a half-life of 52 minutes, meaning if you wait 8 hours after fission is stopped, it's all gone, 99% gone, 8 hours. So sometime within the last 8 hours prior to that reading being taken, there was fission happening in Reactor 2.
It couldn't be
incredible.
Any other way. Yeah.
So there's no other place it can come from. It's fission. So we have a fission. It meltdown is happening right now in at least Reactor 2. My guess is Reactor 3, maybe Reactor 1. We don't know.
And I want to reemphasize for our listeners that I think you had your source dogs in a pile, who everybody's fallen in love with. We had one separate other story or two saying that if there was a catastrophic meltdown at one reactor, all six would go. So we know the wind patterns are that way, but nobody in the mainstream media has dared to even contemplate six Chernobyls multiplied side by side.
Well, if one goes, the radioactivity is going to be so tremendous in that region that they're going to have to back away far enough that they probably can't get to the reactors on either side of it. And if that happens, there's a high likelihood that those will go. And if those go, they won't be able to get to any of them.
That's correct.
So that's sort of the risk here. And here's the thing. I've seen a lot of people explaining that, you know, attempting to explain and minimize it, saying, look, you know, because of the drywall, because of the torus, because of the concrete, because of the, you know, primary containment vessel, and it's all 6 inches of you know, high-grade steel, because there's no chance that this stuff could melt down and escape that and get down to the water table where it could create sort of a cataclysmic steam explosion,
right,
which would vault stuff everywhere. But this whole thing, every step of the way, what I've been told can't happen has happened so far. It's been a worst-case scenario, and I think it's just be prudent for everybody to say, well, what if? Not to listen to people who say can'ts. Don't deal in absolutes. Nobody who says, you know, it's impossible. The impossible has already happened. We're past that. So the question is, if the impossible happens now, what do we want to do? Where do we want to be? What should we be doing?
One of the things that is so alarming to me personally about this is you know, Chris, and a lot of people do, that I've been a journalist for a long time, and I've been a student of the media for a long time. Mm-hmm. I was Ross Perot's press spokesman here in L.A. in 92. And the duplicity and the disingenuity and the cupidity of the reporting is as bad or worse than Deepwater Horizon, which is, you know, also equally alarming. Chris, in your assessment of what's going on there now, I mean, all of my read says it's still a losing battle. I don't think anybody's got a toehold on control anywhere there. And I'm curious about the latest on the fuel rods at Reactor 4 and what's happening with them.
Well, you know, to start with the media, you know, on the first couple of days, I give the media a pass, right? So we have some journalists, and none of them are nuclear engineers. That's why they ended up journalists. And they're going to get the story wrong for a while. But we're 15 days into this now, mm-hmm. and the media should know the difference between radiation and contamination. They're completely separate concepts
in terms of
what you have to do, how you respond to them. If if there's a chunk of radioactivity, like give me a brick of just, it's just an ungodly beta emitter, right? I'm just going to walk 12 feet away from that thing and basically be safe. But if I get a tiny chunk of that, just a tiny chunk of that on me or in me, now we have a whole different ball of wax, because radiation loses effectiveness over distance very, very quickly. But when you're contaminated, the distance basically drops to zero. So we've had 15 days to get this, and I was just reading the New York Times today, and they confused it again. They had just about gotten it right a few days ago. So I'm just wondering, like, how do we lose intelligence, you know, over time? How do we forget something?
I don't think it's accidental.
I'm going to give them an F at this point.
I don't think it's accidental.
I don't think so either.
No.
I don't know how you could be that bad.
No, maybe we can also take some time. But you know, it's like I kind of don't want to take eyes off how bad the situation is there in Japan. Until we've gleaned as much from that as is going to be helpful to our listeners. I mean, I'm in LA right now on the West Coast. I'm moving day after tomorrow to Sonoma. We all want to stress that nothing I have seen has said that there is any imminent danger or any hazard right now on the West Coast of the United States. Chris, are you cool with that?
Yeah, no, I completely share that assessment. The only thing that would make me sit up and try and reanalyze it is if there was some sort of cataclysmic steam explosion and a whole bunch of stuff got tossed in the atmosphere and the wind directions were right, all of that. But that's a lot of ifs, ands, and buts. I mean,
right.
that's very unlikely.
And we have lots of time.
I'm not worried about the radioactivity here in North America. I'm very worried for people in Japan. Depending on wind patterns, I'm very worried for people who live in that region. And I'm extremely worried for what this implies and means and could mean to the world economy.
I get, I read about 120 stories a day for the World News Desk of CollapseNet, and I just got, moments before we went on the air, my first batch for the day, and the Japanese government has just banned all food production in the whole state or prefecture of Fukushima. That's a much larger exclusion area, and they have prohibited plowing, planting, farming, or disturbing the dirt. That sounds an awful lot like Chernobyl to me.
It's exactly the same. You know, Chernobyl, you know, they ultimately did resurrect a bunch of farmland, but what they had to do was take the top 3 to 6 inches of topsoil off, and scraped it off, and it's high-level waste, and they brought it back to ground zero and dumped it there near the sarcophagus. So right now, I guess what they're saying is, and it's no surprise, you know, they had some readings, and it's spotty, you know, it depends where the wind blows, but there was a place 40 kilometers away that showed up with just vast, vast excesses of radioactivity of not just the iodine. The iodine's okay, you know, you wait five half-lives, which in this case would be about 40 days, but you're okay. You know, I would personally feel okay, but it's the cesium-137. It's got a half-life of 30 years.
And the cobalt.
50 years. Cobalt. Oh, my gosh. Same sort of story. There's all kinds of stuff coming out of this thing, and they haven't tested for it yet. I haven't seen them exclude it or not, but plutonium. Plutonium's in there.
Now, my understanding is that they have not, of course, started any of the sarcophagus process. They haven't started dumping because all you would do at this point, from my knowledge and from my family background, is you would create a compression bomb because the chain reaction is not controlled. Had they controlled Chernobyl before they started dumping cement on it?
I think they have to. They at least have to stop the fission. So fission is just creating a massive amount of energy, just a huge amount of heat.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you've ever taken a little bit of black powder and wrapped it up tightly in paper, I mean, that's what we call firecrackers on the 4th of July.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's possible to take something that's emitting a vast quantity of heat and just wrap it up.
No.
You know, it's still going to be venting. It's still going to be a fissure is going to erupt. It's going to break or spall your concrete and, you know, make a fissure all on its own anyway. I mean, something that's emitting a huge amount of heat will have to vent that somehow. And so that's the problem that they're facing right now. And if they know, they're not sharing it. But my guess at this point is they don't really know how much criticality has been reinitiated, and I don't think they know the dimensions of it. You know, they had a report. They said it was from March 13th, 14th, 15th. They told it to us almost a week later, but they said that they had detected neutron beams, which
yes.
are consistent with fission happening in the outside atmosphere in one way or shape or form. We don't know if that's I don't know. Maybe they do. We have no idea if that happened in a containment pool for the spent fuel rods. We don't know if that happened from a reactor that cracked and is open. We don't know any of that. And I'm just appalled that we haven't been given that information so that we can plan.
Yeah, this is we're getting a lot of calls in, Chris. By the way, if you want to call and ask Chris Martinson a question, the number is 1-888-874-4888, or you can email me directly at lifeboathour@collapsenet.com. We've got several questions backing up. We're going to take one question real quick, then we're going to go to a quick musical break because we all need one. We've got John from Redding, California. Are you on the line? John, you're
on. Am I on?
Yeah, you're on. You're
hey,
live.
Hey, nice to talk to you, Michael Rupert, a CollapseNet member and a fireman in Northern California. I just got a quick question. In watching Japan and go through its meltdown, my question is, if we had a solar flare or an IED, would we have simultaneous meltdowns in potentially hundreds of reactors around the world as all their electric pumps and electronics and generation systems all failed?
I think you're talking about EMP, electromagnetic pulse. But, Chris, you want to try that?
Well, he's right, too. If there was a really massive solar flare, which is, you know, sort of a disaster scenario that I've seen specced out, it could create a surge load that would basically ruin a whole lot of electrical equipment all at once. I don't think that would particularly so that kind of a surge can really, if it runs across the power lines, can do all kinds of horrible things to a lot of electronics. But the way they've designed the nuclear plants, their backup electrical systems are pretty much offline. I mean, they have redundant systems. This was a horrible situation that happened there. They were, for whatever reason, they hadn't thought of a tsunami this high, and they had some other design features there that were kind of unique that were poor. One is that they have four separate diesel generators, which were all like, you know, one failed, you had two, three, and four in line. But all of those were hooked up to the cooling pumps. via two separate redundant switching panels. Both of those were located in the basement level. Salt water got in there from the tsunami and fried basically their entire circuitry. So that was a bad moment. I'm reasonably convinced that you know, with a solar flare or something like that, the redundant systems on most plants would be okay. And we have to remember that these particular designs, the GE Mark V's, these are really old. They require constant cooling in order to operate. There are a lot of other designs out there that do not require pumps in order to cool. They can cool by convection. There was just some things that went wrong here. But I am in favor, personally, in favor of shutting down all of the GE Mark V's that are out there running right now until we figure out how we can make sure this doesn't happen again, because this has the chance of basically turning a very large swath of one of the most heavily industrialized nations on the planet into an unlivable swath of land for a very long period of time. That's unacceptable.
Yeah, John. John, thank you for calling. I remember sitting in Paris in 2003 at my first ASPO conference. We were at a little chateau in Rueil-Malmaison, and I was sitting with Colin Campbell, Jean Laherrere, Matthew Simmons, and a few other notables in the peak oil movement. And I remember a very strenuous, a very sincere discussion, and Colin Campbell saying, we have to shut down all nuclear reactors everywhere before the collapse takes place, because if we don't, they will blow up on us afterwards. And a lot of thought's been given to this, and we look at the lengths to which mankind is struggling, grasping, clawing, desperately reaching for energy, which is harder to find, which is more dangerous, which is putting us in ever more precarious positions. And we can certainly say that this is not the first such accident. We have many more events like this to look forward to unless we pay attention right now. Which brings us up to our standard musical break with a song from New White Trash. Some of the songs that we wrote at New White Trash, I swear. As I play them, I go, how could we have known to write this song? The song we're going to play tonight is called Weird Kind of Sense. And there's a line that I recorded that didn't make it onto the final cut. We just had to get it out. But there was a line that I wrote in this song that said, we looked into the fire and the fire looked back. Let's see if you can find out where it goes. This is Weird Kind of Sense.
Oh, what a mess we left you. What a mess we left you. Against the odds of the gods, we left you such a mess. Posting on the TV. Thank you.
into the fire, and the fire looked back. You can find us at newwhitetrash.com, 37 original songs, double CD, double wide. You can get it all there. We got an important show. I'm cutting the commercial short. We got too much to talk about. We got a few minutes before the break. I'm going to read a question, Chris. Hi, Mike and Chris. I'm a member of CollapseNet and also an enrolled member of ChrisMartinson.com. Well, you are definitely not the slowest camper. I realize that you are talking about the unfolding nuclear disaster in Japan, but my question is related to economics and finance. My wife and I own a few U.S. savings bonds, Series 1, that mature this November. Would it be prudent to cash them in November, or sooner? We would like to know your thoughts on this. Thank you. From Himanshu. Chris, you want to talk on that?
Well, you know, we're getting into some really desperate territory here. My highest level advice, without specifically speaking to savings bonds, is that for people who have a significant portion of their net worth stored over what I'm going to call the paper world, that's stocks, bonds, all different kinds of things, I'm not even going to talk about which ones you might have. My highest advice is to make sure that you've got, some significant portion of that retracted out into the real world. That's the land you live on. These are the things that you might need, productive assets if you can invest in those. Maybe that's productive farmland or woodland or, a local business that's going to go really well. These are the kinds of things that I've been trying to direct people towards, because what's unknowable at this point is the timing of when the United States itself is going to finally experience some larger fiscal crisis, monetary crisis that will itself start in the Treasury market, in the U.S. bond market. I mean, that's a powder keg. It's clearly unsustainable. We know it's sooner or later it's going to have a day of reckoning. We just don't know when.
I've been in touch with the studio. We're going to roll right over the station break. What's the FCC going to do? Come and nail us? This is too important. And let me just say, in response to that question, I chuckled, and forgive me if it sounded insensitive or crass, but we got a lot really important things to worry about right now. And I'm not saying that your question was not important at all. I certainly don't mean to say that, but we really need to focus on the imminent danger, because Chris and I are we're going to spend a lot of time in the show tonight on what the other fallouts are, and I'm sure that Chris and I are both like stupefied at the fallout we've already seen. I just had an email message from a CollapseNet member who asked me to announce on the air. I'm having a going away party tonight at Rush Street Restaurant right after the show ends here in Culver City. There's three CollapseNet members have emailed saying, "Can I still come?" Yes, please come. They did an RSVP. That's over with. Let's go. Let's get on with it. Okay, now, Chris, it's the fallout from this that I think we both have been tracking, and I don't think my jaw could fall any further toward the floor. I read a list of companies that have either fully or partially suspended production in Japan on my latest member-only video alert, and it was a long, frightening list compiled from Bloomberg by a bunch of other guys, a.k.a. Tyler Durden at Zero Hedge, who have also been doing just amazing work during this crisis. This Sony, Mitsubishi, all of the biggest, the list is frightening. But the bottom line is that Japan has lost two different stories, numbers that I've seen, between 8.7 and 9.7 gigawatts of electrical generating capacity. Industrial civilization does not function without electricity. That can't be replaced. There's another reactor, I think 50, 60 kilometers away, and it's a completely different complex, that has also been shut down. The follow-on effects are moving around the world. I reported on, we had a story from Der Spiegel in Germany saying that six major German manufacturers have shut down because they cannot obtain Japanese components. And we know that auto plants here in the States are closing or shutting down. And we saw a story that said there are going to be 30% fewer cars being manufactured as a result of this. Now, extrapolate this. That's just in the direction of electricity. But bear in mind, the summer is coming in Japan, and a rice farmer who gathers some of our stories for us lives in Japan. He's part of the heart of CollapseNet, and I've been getting daily reports from him. And he stated the obvious, that there will be no air conditioning in any of the office buildings in Tokyo this summer. Chris, what's notable to you about the follow-on economically?
This is the biggest part of the story for me.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we live in a global integrated economy now, and all the supply chains are heavily internoded with each other, if you will. And what we didn't know right at the outset was how many critical Japanese processes for raw goods, for intermediate, for finished goods, how many of those were going to be impacted by this. You know, without knowing that, within 24 hours of this whole thing breaking, I was alerting people saying, hey, this is going to be a really big deal. You know, even as the mainstream press was busy trotting people out saying, oh, not a really big deal, you know, other manufacturers will step in and fill the void. You know what? They will, eventually. But the problem is the electricity, as you mentioned. Let's start with that. Right now, TEPCO operates in an area that serves about 40% of Japan's total GDP is served by TEPCO. TEPCO, coincidentally, has just lost about 40% of its manufacturing capacity, its total thermal capacity. Not just the six reactors that are gone down, but there were two just to the south, the Daiichi complex. There were a couple up north. They've had a which are shut down right now, and trust me, they're going to be slow opening those back up, and they're going to want to make sure all the T's are crossed and the I's are dotted. And they have some hydro plants, but it's been very dry, and it's just been a bad string of circumstances. So what do you do when you have 40% of your base load that you used to have?
Right.
Well, you'll make up some of that by turning the air conditioning down a little bit and doing some power downs and some rolling brownouts, but you can't make up 40%. So they're going to have to actually go into critical shutdown and triage of electrical sort of distribution as they go forward. And there are certain industries which just can't operate on half rations, right?
Right.
The wafer industry, semiconductor wafer industry, either those machines are running or they're not. The aluminum smelters, they're running or they're not. There's no in-between state. You know, we'll just brown out here for a couple hours. So we'll see how they manage all of that. We don't know yet. They don't know. It's too early to tell because they're dealing with a very severe crisis. They should have all eyes focused on that. That's what they're doing. But here's a prediction. 40% of Japan's economy is about to take probably a 10, 20, or 30% hit.
Yes.
Just from the electrical component of this. If we get into something worse and, you know, wind blows back on shore and there's some big radiological event that now causes the vacation, if you will, of a large area, it'll be a larger impact. So here's the main concern I have. We're about to take the world's third largest economy, and basically it was operating at about 50 miles an hour,
yes,
and we're about to slam it into reverse. And
it was operating at 50 miles an hour and slowing rapidly.
And slowing, but it was still moving at a pretty good clip. But we're about to see something we've never seen before, which is what happens when you take a fully industrialized first world economy and immediately starve it for energy.
Yeah.
Energy drives everything, and it's not just electricity. The liquid fuels, they lost a third of their refining capacity, and they'll bring it back online, but they are suffering both from a liquid fuel and an electricity fuel shortage at this point in time. And so this is, to be crass about it, this is a petri dish. We are about to, the rest of the world gets to peer in and say, what does happen when you power down a first world economy? We don't know.
I'm getting tons of questions here. There's a guy named Mark Phillips who has been writing questions frequently. He's written several times. He asks a lot of specific questions that are all related to his personal financial situation. I am not going to take the time to read that question on the air or digress there, but I will tell you, Mark, that in the Lighthouse directory at CollapseNet, you will find checklists, you will find complete matrices for how you can answer all your questions. The Lighthouse directory has more than 1,150 hand-picked entries, taking like 700-800 man hours to put together over our time. It's free, and there are people who have asked all these questions for you. But he asks also a question, how, in your opinions, Mike and Chris, is the best way to get, and I can hear somebody being frantic about this, especially now. How, in your opinions, Mike and Chris, is the best way to get a significant other, wife, close family, and friends to take a few hours to sit the hell down, shut up, pay attention, listen, and hear what I and all of us are trying to convey to them? I just can't seem to get anyone to take any more than 30 seconds of this. Chris?
That's the hardest question you can possibly ask.
Yeah.
And I think we covered this last time I talked a little bit with you. Listen, this is a really traumatic incident, and a lot of people are still in denial about it. I had a member of mine, who, very valuable person to me, who's been in Japan. He's been a member of my site for 2.5 years. And he finally wrote in and said, I don't want to hear anymore. Please don't send me anything. And when I asked him why, there were a number of complexities to it. But one thing that jumped out was this, that when the information I was providing was conflicting so heavily with the reality that was, being presented in other ways, he couldn't deal with it anymore. And I understand that completely. It happens all the time. We are in the middle of the biggest set of changes that have ever come up in our lifetimes. It's just huge. And a lot of people are going to have really emotional, difficult times trying to confront this information. And the future is not something that's going to come later. We're right in the middle of this. The change is now upon us.
This is collapse with a capital C. Let me share something that happened to me. I was going to the bank. I was going to turn in my safety deposit box. Time to get out of your safety deposit boxes now anyway. If you've got stuff in, I would get it out now. And it's like a ridiculously short drive. I mean, there's 3 stoplights, but it's maybe a mile away. And in that, I saw like three people in cars. Just one was just sitting through a green light, you know. One was totally not paying attention and made a right turn from the far left hand, and then on the way back, I saw 3 major moving violations. One of which almost caused an accident with me, and people are starting to lose it. And that's why I am so fearful for the big cities. Forget all the prognostications I had made on world events up until Japan happened. Japan has changed everything.
Yeah, it really has people a little bit confused, a little bit on edge. But with all of that said, so some people are going to retreat into a little bit of a haze. Maybe some people will go fully into denial and say, I can't listen to this.
Mm-hmm.
On the other side of that, this is one of our most teachable moments that we've had since 2008.
Yes.
This is when the crack opens up a little bit. This is when people are ready to hear a little bit. And my advice, such as it is that the only way I know to reach people, and this has always been true for me, is I can't come at them with a sense of urgency, a charge, my own emotions, whether I'm angry, whether I'm fearful, whether I'm depressed, any of my emotions. I have to find a way to check those at the door and come to them and say, I have some information that's really important to me that you share it with me. I'm looking at the world in a way, and if you could just look at it this way with me for a second and decide for yourself, is this a way you could look at it or not, this would be very important to me.
The other thing that I might try, because I've been at this for a long time too, and believe me, I've talked to a lot of people for a decade who didn't want to hear it.
Yeah.
It would be to say to the person that you love, something like, "Hey, things are really bad. They're far worse than you could imagine. If you want to know more, and when you want to know more, I'm here to talk about it." And then just leave it alone. Just plant that little tiny seed, and don't try to hit anybody with a hammer.
Yeah.
Okay, we got a lot more questions. This is from Mark Multer in Cleveland, Ohio. Question for Chris. If you were leader of Japan, I wouldn't want that job. Would you be telling people in Tokyo to begin voluntary evacuations? How would this impact the Japanese economy and world economy? Looks to me like we have global QE now taking place. I don't know what he means by that. But what would you do if you were president, if you were emperor?
Well, that's a really tough question. What I've been doing, in my own small way, whenever I can, is I've been counseling people to get out. to get further away. If you simply overlay a map of Chernobyl, you know, and its total fallout effects on top of Japan, you find that it handily covers, at least the outer reaches of it, handily covers Tokyo. The problem is that this is an island nation of 130 million people or so, and a third of that population is within the potential fallout zone if we went out 100 miles from the Fukushima complex. This is a really difficult question because I don't know exactly what I would do, because you can't have a third of a nation move to the other two-thirds. It's just a logistical impossibility.
There are
almost
13.5 million people in Tokyo. You cannot evacuate Tokyo. It is not possible.
But what I would be doing is I would now be planning for the idea that a whole lot of people are going to have to shelter in place. So if something happens, so what we're really worried about here is that there's some big release. You know, a meltdown happens, a steam explosion happens, something happens, and a whole bunch of really hot stuff gets ejected. The idea for what you want to do next is to not be out in the open. You want to shelter in place. You don't want to be exposed to any of that contamination. So, you know, this gets back to those images of people going into their houses and sealing up the windows with tape and plastic and all that, right? It's a very unpleasant set of images. But if people are going to shelter in place like that, they don't have to do it forever. They have to do it while the contamination is falling. Hopefully, you know, it falls quickly and a rain happens and, you know, it gets washed away relatively quickly. You know, obviously there's still long-term effects, but there's a critical period you want to avoid. To do that, you need to shelter in place. Well, to do that, you need food and water. You need the tape already there. You need the basic goods. If the leader of Japan can't tell the people to do that because they're worried about inciting panic of some form, then the next thing they have to do is they have to be stockpiling that stuff at zones where they could rapidly get it to people. But in all honesty, if I was the leader of Japan, I'd be saying, listen, this is a very serious situation. We don't have it under control yet. There are a lot of unknowns. This could go in a number of directions.
Right.
In all likelihood, it's going to be safe and the stuff will, you know, blow out to sea or you know, the worst case won't happen. But we have to be prepared for the idea that it might. And
I am not.
What you should do.
I am not at all convinced, Chris, that even if we were to take a snapshot of the situation in Japan at this moment and freeze it here, that the Japanese government is capable of feeding, keeping hydrated, keeping warm the people that have already been dislocated because of the enormous issues now with fuel, with electricity, with transportation, with exposure, with etc. I don't even know how they can take care of the people that they've got now in place if there's who are displaced, if let alone if there is a complete meltdown. Do you think they can do it?
No. So this is instructive again, I think, on some level, which is I think back to Katrina, you know, so again, a pretty vigorous event, and I think I'm going to have to give the government that was in place at the time and a D-minus on their efforts there.
Yeah.
In the first, you know, in the early parts of that crisis. And the same thing is happening now, I think, in Japan, in my estimation, where there are a whole lot of people who are basically stranded in these outer zones, you know, within that 30-kilometer exclusion zone, who are there, they're stuck, they can't really leave, their infrastructure is ruined, they've,
right.
you know, still got quake damage to deal with, and no supplies are getting to them. And it's just sort of a mess, right? And that's expected because when you have events like this, the first thing that I try and work with people around is the idea that as long as everything's working, you can rely on a lot of systems being there for you, including government help, including
right.
you know private charity help, including your neighbors, including all kinds of things. But that after a certain moment in a crisis, a lot of those things that you were counting on, those fall back to you.
Yep.
And so it's our responsibility as individuals to be responsible for our own outcomes and those of the people around us. And so preparing is really, really important. And this lesson that we're learning watching in Japan again is the same one. It seems to be independent of culture. They have a very different culture,
yes.
very different political system, completely different. And yet we find the sort of responses are the same. There's sort of a paralysis.
It's corporate.
There's something that happens.
We got a bunch more questions. We have a question for you, Chris, from Shanti M. To us. Thank you. I have an important question for Chris as well. I read on the World News Desk earlier today that Japan is challenging the U.S. et al.'s decision to ban imports, especially food imports, citing U.N. World Trade Agreements. Are they just whining, or do you think this ban will stand? Oh, it's going to stand.
Oh, it's going to stand because, you know, China already barred one vessel that they turned it away at port because they discovered it was fully contaminated, and it had only passed 65 miles away from the Fukushima complex. We've already had radiation is already sneaking out in the cargo vessels. So we might not we will actually ban certain types of imports. So I bet you anything we'll follow along with their complete ban on the Fukushima prefecture agricultural products. Fine.
Absolutely.
Guess what? Those are done. But what we're also going to do is we're going to have to screen every single cargo container, even of things that we allow. They're all going to have to be screened, not just for the gamma radiation, which is easy. You can detect it from a distance, but for the alpha and beta emitters, which might be riding along. Those are harder. You have to be within a meter. So we're talking individual guys and gals with handheld scanners going from cargo container to cargo container just trying to figure this out.
Right.
Oh, my gosh. Think how slow that's going to push everything down. It's an intense mess.
We've got about 10 minutes left, Chris, and there's a lot of people stacked up. And there's a guy, Robert from Brooklyn, who's been very patient. He's on the line. He's got a question. Robert, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hello, Michael. Hello, Chris.
Thanks for waiting. I'm sorry. I forgot about you. Sorry,
no problem. Can you hear me clearly?
Speak. You're
sure
good.
Can.
Okay, great. You know, I wanted to tell you that I am not an alarmist. However, even though the detectors in this country are not measuring high levels of radiation, the issue is, in particular, certain isotopes, in particular plutonium, which is very deadly and very lethal. So even if you have, it is like 1,000 to 10,000 times more lethal than even uranium. You understand the difference between radiation and radioactivity. Plutonium, once it gets into your body, especially if it's inhaled, it really goes through your body and implodes like all the mitochondria and the DNA. And what people have to be aware of is that this is much worse than the Chernobyl incident.
Yes.
Because you were dealing with a MOX reactor, which was 7% plutonium and 93% uranium. And there was an explosion where it cast up an enormous amount of plutonium into the atmosphere, which is now really over the United States and even Europe at this point.
You know your stuff, Robert.
I do. And you could... I asked people to Google a gentleman. His name is Azov Dorokovich, Dorokovic. He was a gentleman who studied the after effects of all the deaths and cancer that resulted from Chernobyl. Chernobyl lost 23% of its it was uranium that was released.
We have a time problem.
These are four reactors we're dealing with. We know that one exploded. A certain amount percentage was released. And what also was happening was not people understand is that there was a lot of plutonium that was in cooling ponds, and that burned off, and it was released into the atmosphere. So even though detectors in America and Europe may not be measuring relatively high levels of radioactivity,
we're going to have to move on. I've got a whole bunch of stacked up callers here, and I have to get to these other callers.
Okay, I understand. I just want to let that out, that people really have to take some measures to make sure that they don't take this plutonium into their system.
Okay, yes.
There are ways. Gary Null even talked about ways of eliminating radioactivity
from
systems.
Thank you, Robert. Okay, they really are piling up here. This is a good question, Chris. This is from Justin Wachholder. In a nutshell, what do you, Chris, believe at this time, with the current information available, will be the end result in Japan? Do you think it will end with a catastrophic meltdown? Thanks. Chris?
So I'm going to qualify this and double and requalify it. We're way out in speculation territory. First of all, we're not at the nadir of this particular incident yet. It's getting worse. They do not yet have it under control. It could literally go any direction at all from this point forward. The concern I would have, I don't ever deal in absolutes, but ideal impossibilities and probabilities.
Mm-hmm.
To me, there's a high probability, meaning 20, 30, 40%, something really unacceptably high, that one or more of these reactor cores and or one of these pools, we don't know which it is at this point, that has gone recritical, is going to basically escape.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, there's a very high chance of that. Escape meaning it's going to basically become open air, and we're going to have an incredible difficulty getting that back under control because we can't get close to it, all of that. So I do think there's a very high chance of that. The thing that I'm concerned, even if they stopped it right now, is going to happen is they're going to discover when they finally take scans that there's a whole swath of the countryside that is no longer safe. There's an enormous cleanup issue there. Don't forget, they still haven't even remotely begun to deal with the quake impacts, the tsunami impacts. They've got a huge rebuilding effort to do. In the context of that rebuilding and a fuel emergency, I could see them basically just cordoning off whole sections and saying, can't get to it. It's unlivable. Nobody's moving back there for now.
And
it's a big area. It's going to have a huge economic impact. That's going to ripple across the world.
To me, it was clear from the start when the nuclear crisis started that Japan's economic back is broken. There's a 96% correlation between greenhouse gas emission and GDP growth. In other words, you can't grow GDP without transportation, oil, coal. And the whole economic structure, now that we've been printing money hand over fist, driving the planet to these absurd extremes, there will be no more economic growth. Japan can't even get back to a GDP level that it was at before the earthquake. That's global GDP, and you have now, I forget what Nicole Foss said the latest estimate of derivatives was, but you have $2 trillion dollars worth of derivatives out there that are going to implode because there is no more growth, especially with all these other industries shutting down. I fear for Japan as a nation, as a whole. For its future and for its people, I don't see any bounce back or come back from this anywhere. Chris, we've got about 5 minutes left. Do you want to venture into immediate impacts that we might foresee in the world around us as a result of what's going on?
Well, you know, I've got a piece I've been writing for about a week. I'm trying to figure out how to get it out, and the working title of it is "In Search of a White Swan." We're surrounded by black swans at this point. I hardly even know what to analyze. It's a very stressful period for me because I like to stay on top of everything. It's all I can do to try and stay on top of Japan. To wade over into the Middle East, North Africa region for a second. All of which is
getting worse.
Oh, my gosh. And then on Saturday, you know, two Fed governors decided to come out and talk about how they want to end QE. And then we look at what's going on in Europe and there's bond spreads blowing out across the Irish, the Portuguese bonds, Spain's probably next. I mean, it's almost impossible to keep on top of it.
And let me throw this in. This is like the cherry on top of the sundae you just built. The U.S. Navy has just taken a U.S. aircraft carrier battle group from off of Libya and sent it to the Straits of Hormuz, and I know exactly what that's about. They're afraid Saudi Arabia is ready to go. Now, Saudi Arabia is 25% of the known oil on the planet, providing between 9 and 10% of the world's supply of oil, and oil prices are skyrocketing as we speak tonight. And stories are showing up everywhere about how things are shutting down as a result of that. This is it. I mean, this is so obviously it, you know, the biggest capital IT that anybody could describe. And Chris, do you share that urgency with me?
Well, I really do. My model for how the world works. And by the way, if I could just plug it really quick, my book just came out.
Please.
And it's called The Crash Course: The Unsustainable Future of Our Economy, Energy, and the Environment. And in that book, I actually paint multiple scenarios in one of the chapters around how this is going to unfold. Not because I think I can pick what the actual scenario is going to be, but but they're a useful way to help frame our thinking and say, you know, get some meat on the bones. You know, so when I say things like there could be a currency crisis, what's that mean? You know, but here, let me paint that for you. We have now the highest risk I've ever assessed in all the years I've been doing this of something really going fundamentally haywire in our overall world economic and, most importantly, financial system. And by haywire, I mean, here's a quick scenario. Japan, the tent folds for a while. Tokyo clears out because the wind blew the wrong way and there was some sort of an incident. If that happens, the Nikkei gets shut down. More importantly, the Tokyo banking center gets shut down. Everything's correlated. They're all interlinked. There are no bulkheads left in this ship.
Exactly.
The whole ship, the world's financial ship, is now one big open container, and we just got flooding in one compartment. Well, the only way we know about to control that is to just cut all the markets off from each other. That's a concern I have.
I'm sorry to cut you off, dude, but we are running out of time. I want to thank you so much. There's a whole movement out here. That is so glad you were on the show. We had some really big numbers of listeners tonight, and I know it was a great show. You can find Chris at chrismartinson.com, the Crash Course. He's in our directory at CollapseNet. Chris, let's stay in touch, and I really look forward to the outstanding work you're doing. Take care of yourself, but we need you right now, man. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Well, that was a fast hour. Before I sign off tonight, let me just say that this will be my last broadcast from my home in Culver City. The moving van arrives at 8 a.m., and I'll be up in Sevastopol by next Wednesday. There's a lot of change going on. As soon as I sign off here tonight, I have to go. I want to go. I'm looking forward to going to a goodbye party for me at my favorite restaurant, Rush Street, here in Culver City. I'm going to meet with CollapseNet members, and these are strong times and feelings are strong, and let the love shine. Stay in the now. Hang tight with us. We're the fastest campers out here, and we're a great bunch of people, and we all gather together every week on the Lifeboat Hour. I'll see you next week. Bye bye.